Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
HQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Oh, wait, he's not an intruder, he's just a foreigner. Good evening. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and your cruise director, Madame Perry. And as everyone knows, I am super psyched tonight because my guest, this is one of my favorite guests, and I always, actually, he's the most popular guest, according to the stats for the show. I'm going to have to just haul him right in here through the beaded curtains in the Madame Perry Salon. The fabulous one and only. He's a filmmaker, author, stand-up poet, activist, political activist, and so much more. Mr. Jasper Bark. Jasper Bark, come on in, sugar.
I'm generally, you know, just a troublemaker. The whole business with being a poet, writing books, that's just a big cover to kind of explain why I'm kind of rarely out of trouble.
Yes, I was at a client's today and I was reading, I was showing them your website and reading the section of your About Me section, saying how you shamed and upset your father. So.
yes, I've been a constant disappointment, but there you go.
Yeah, because you married the Duke of Montrose's granddaughter.
That's right. Now the Duke of Montrose's niece, because that particular Duke is sadly no longer with us.
Oh, okay. Which puts you as a you're in Berks and Debrett's. With peerage and
Book of Peerage, and my father, yes, who spent years as a rabble rousing union man, also gets put in with me. So he was most disappointed about that, I can tell you.
Yeah, can you blame him?
No, not really. Bless his heart.
But they love
I think
your
he's
wife.
Now. Sorry, what?
But
I adore
go ahead.
My wife. But
no,
I
said your
absolutely...
family. Your family does.
Oh, they how could they not?
Yeah.
She's an absolutely amazing woman. So, basically, and probably one of the few really good decisions, and definitely one of the best things I ever did in my life was marrying her.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And so that makes you a peer of the realm. Is that what it's called? I don't know a lot about, you know, I read a lot, but I still don't get the whole system there.
I think... it makes me, the French would call it a parvenu or an arriviste, which basically is a commoner, because my background, I'm a gypsy. And my parents met when my mother fell in the River Thames and my father fished her out and onto his houseboat.
Oh.
That was the highly romantic way in which they met. Wasn't exactly when Harry met Sally, but yeah. Probably when Harry met Soggy, I think, in their case, actually. But I'm not technically a peer, also because I'm male, and you don't get any hereditary things coming down from the female line. So neither I nor my daughters are ennobled. That was my wife, actually. Her mum's a lady, but she doesn't actually have a title.
Oh, okay. All right. So, because as I said, you know, I read a lot. I've studied the royal families all the way back to the text. And I used to be in a history club, a little informal group that had these events every year for the battles of Worcestershire and Battle of Isandlwana. and such. Mm-hmm. But I still never can grasp the whole thing. All I know is that I was reading a book once about Wallace and David, and it was after, you know, they'd been exiled, I think, to Bermuda or somewhere. No, not Bermuda. Where was it? Anyway, they were with some friends and deciding that, you know, well, David had to get now that he's not going to be, he's not in line to be the king, he needs to learn to do regular things and get a driver's license. They said, well, what will you put on as the occupation? And she and the women were talking about this. Well, what will you put as his occupation? And she looked over and sees that here he is, the former heir to the throne, with the other guys, whizzing in the bushes, and says, I think you'll be peer of the realm. So that's all I, you know.
Yes, I'm not quite that grand. Yes, and certainly as one of the common members of the family, I'm certainly not allowed to whiz in the bushes. I'm sort of sent round to the back of the castle for the tradesman's entrance.
Okay, all right. Well, this is, you know, I'm always so thrilled to have you here, and you are here tonight to talk about, you have not one, not two, but three brand new novels out. They are The Final Cut, Run to Ground, and Bed of Crimson Joy. And I'm so excited about them. So you're going to tell us all about them or give us some teasers as to... I got to tell you, Final Cut,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not through with yet because I'll read and I go back. You had me right away from the beginning. You know, it's that kind of story, the beginning. You know, sometimes people say everybody has to go with the first paragraph or page or whatever has to pull you in or something. When you start reading the opening scene of The Final Cut, do you want to know how I found it? It's like that monster that they under the bed that they told you was imaginary, and it mm-hmm. has reached up out from under the bed and clamped an iron fist on you and won't let you go.
To hear that.
Yeah,
I'm so pleased that it grabbed you. One or two people were slightly put off, but obviously I've had quite a few reviews in now, and one or two reviewers said was a bit put off by the beginning. One or two because they thought it was too harsh, and one or two because they didn't think it was harsh enough, which is very strange because it's quite full on. But they all said if you keep reading, it gets amazing. So don't be put off like I was. So if the beginning's a little bit too bloodthirsty for you, keep going, because there's lots to keep gripping you. Basically, the basic nub of the story, it's set, The Final Cut, in the world of indie horror filmmaking, which is very big at the moment. There's a lot of filmmakers who are managing to make a living. In the past, they would have put their film straight to video. These days, you don't even have to sell a video or a Blu-ray of your movie. You can put it up on view on demand, VOD, on places like Vimeo and YouTube and lots of other streaming sites, and people will pay to watch your movie. And if it's good enough, if it's gore enough, if it gets enough of a following, you can make mm-hmm. Quite a bit of money just charging people to stream it on the internet. And these are two guys who are involved in this. But they find themselves, unfortunately, massively in debt to an Iranian loan shark, which was not a clever idea whatsoever at all, particularly as they tried to use some of the money to raise greater funds for their film. They tried to use some of the money he gave them in a drugs deal with one of his competitors, which went completely tits up. He sits them down in a little lockup in Bethnal Green, which is a particularly rough part of London, and plays them a snuff film and says, if you don't give me back my money, you're going to star in the next one of these movies. And while they're watching it, mostly everyone in the room, everyone except for them in the entire room, is completely slaughtered, not just kind of like in a kind of stabby way, but absolutely, totally decimated. And they find themselves in possession of the only copy of the snuff film, one of the most extreme things they've ever seen. And they hit upon the idea of actually, they could probably save themselves a bomb on special effects if they were to take the snuff film and actually build a movie around it. And this particularly bad decision sets them off on an extremely dodgy train of events, particularly when they're auditioning actresses, and the actress who turns up to see them is the absolute spitting image of the main victim in the snuff movie. But neither she nor the movie they're watching are entirely what they seem to be. And before they know it, they're caught up in a huge chain of events, which takes them to the city beneath the city and also finds them completely embroiled in ancient Mesopotamian myth cycles and a heresy that stretches from the beginning of time to the end of the world as we know it.
And, you know, I'm going to read the Kev Harrison of This Is Horror, the blog magazine. You know, he starts at the pull quote at the top is, just when you're convinced that the level of depravity, oh, that level of depravity could not be reached again during the course of the text, Bart manages to ramp it up just a little more with horrors far more gut-wrenching around the corner.
Yes, if you think it starts bad.
Yeah.
But it will take you. It's also on a slightly kind of like deeper level. It's a book about why we write, why we watch, why we read, why we film horror fiction. What is it that impels us to dwell on these type of imageries and these sort of storylines? And also, to a degree, it's also a book about the importance of storytelling itself. So it will explore a lot of different types of horror. There is psychological horror, and there is dark fantasy, as well as body horror. And it builds up to a big mythopoeic ending. A grand finale. And I doubt you'll see it coming either.
Oh, because and this, what is this, says? And again, Kev Harrison goes on and says, the violence in the text is appalling, but in the most complimentary way possible. I know you've read that, but...
which was great. One person said, an Amazon reviewer said, you know those rides, like those water slides where you're going at the top and you're swung absolutely round and dropped upside down and turned end over end and then drop in a pool with absolutely no idea how you got there or what you feel like or what happened? That's how I felt reading this novel. which I thought was a very complimentary analogy. I was very pleased with that.
Yes, it is. And who wrote that? Who said that?
That was, I think that reviewer's name was Mary Ann Ellis, who subsequently went and bought all my other books, which was much, I'm pleased to say. So obviously the book did the business for her.
You know, it's
Sorry, I was just going to say that's exactly what you want as an author. For one of your books to act as an avatar or as an advocate for the rest of your books and get people to, because I don't know about you, but I love it when I discover an author and a book is so amazing. I think I must now read everything this person has written.
Everything, yes. And because you just can't grasp it or you cannot grok enough of it, you know, it's like
absolutely.
They can't write fast enough. And now here's the one in a Splatterpunk Zine. Have you read this review? This is by Corey Klein. Yeah, the start is Jasper Bark knows about the pain a creative person puts into their work in order to see it come to life. The blood, sweat, and tears that an artist mashes together and vomits onto the canvas of their choice in an effort to create their creative masterpiece. He knows that artists are voyeurs. And then as it goes on, in an attempt to make some sort of sense of the madness they witness so they can use it as fuel for their art. But then, he says, and the final cut is a dark glimpse into the extremes that some artists are willing to go in order to see their art become a reality. And he goes on to tell the story about the film student wannabes, Jimmy and Sam, and the snuff film and so forth. And I'm just going to lift a couple of little highlights out of the last two paragraphs. Jasper's usual gore-soaked insanity fills the pages of this brilliant book, of this brilliant look into the pains of modern filmmaking. His writing is vulgar, humorous, full of enough blood spatter to force the reader to treat his books like a Gallagher fan with front row seats.
Yes, you may need to take a shower after reading it.
That's what he says. You know, so where at the very part is this, there's a lot to do when a film's on the editing room floor before it gets to a red carpet premiere. And Jasper unrolls a very different kind of red carpet, so wear galoshes.
Isn't that a lovely thing for him to say?
Is that what now?
I said, isn't that a lovely thing for him to say?
Well, I find it so, yeah.
I thought so. How sweet. I maybe won't send a copy to my maiden aunt, but... But I was very pleased when I read that. That was very, very sweet of him.
So, was there a particular situation that happened? I'm not going to go too far into your personal life, especially if you know some people like this, but what brought the idea to create this? And there are so many stories and layers in this, and that's why it's such a fascinating book, The Final Cut. But what was the spark that brought this?
Interestingly, it was while I was working on another novel, a novel that I haven't actually completed yet. It's a novel that contains stories within stories, and in a quite what you would these days call a picaresque way, in that people tell stories within the ongoing narrative. And I originally conceived of this story for The Final Cut as just a little short detour within an overall novel. But the idea kept growing, and I thought at first it would just be like a 10,000 word chapbook, and somebody commissioned me to write one of those, so I sat down to write this. But the story just kept growing, and it kept growing, and it kept growing, a bit like one of those mad scientists who sort of drops an ant on a petri dish and hits it with some with a strange radiation ray, and it suddenly grows so large it's the size of a city block. This story was a bit like that. It just would not stop growing. And it suddenly occurred to me as I was writing that there were all kinds of depths to this story that I hadn't previously seen. And it was a story that would allow me to say something about what I was doing as a writer myself and the medium in which I worked, about horror fiction. So there was, at some point, I had to kind of admit it wasn't a short story. Then I had to admit it wasn't going to be like a short novelette for a chapbook. And then it wasn't going to be a novella. It was going to be a full-blown novel. So it just kept growing. And it just kept demanding that I put more into it.
And, of course...
Mm-hmm.
You have, I was with the character, with the two guys in the beginning, especially when they're looking at this film and they're talking about what they can do. And one of them says, you know, hey, you know, we're not Tom Savini here. And I thought, oh, I love Tom Savini. I'm such a fan of his. And
I
all
love Tom Savini's work. Well, he's an absolute genius.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. I think the first time I saw him and really and knew who he was watching From Dusk Till Dawn. Because I think he acted in that as well. And at that time, he was wearing his hair kind of long, curly. And then he was on the cover of a magazine after that. It might have been Fangoria or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked like to me, which is funny that he was playing a guitar. And he looked like my friend Rick Richards from the Georgia Satellite. You know, that same big hair, flash like stuff. So yeah. Tom Savini, yeah. So,
yeah, okay, he's one of those guys, particularly in his prime, that I think, while not classically good looking, are extremely sexy. My daughter's generation referred to them as a weird crush. It's like when you crush on somebody who isn't specifically kind of classically handsome or classically beautiful, but you still have the hots for.
And they call it what? A weird crush?
A weird crush. Yeah, my weird crush is, or I have a weird crush on.
You learn a lot from your daughters, do you?
they're lovely in that they share an awful lot with me. And we're not of the same generation of parents that our parents were, who would just generally roll their eyes and disapprove of anything that we did or said. I tend to be a bit more open to the stuff, so I learn a lot more. And frankly, those are going to be my readers of tomorrow, so I need to kind of keep up with what they're...
There you go.
What they're into.
Well, yeah, of course. And by the way, I had a message, have a couple of messages for you that have come in through the message on Facebook. So if you can't get to a phone and you want to call in and talk to Jasper Bark or ask him a question or tell him how you haven't slept or taken a shower for years because of one of his books. You know, please do. The number here is 646-716-9922 here at Madame Perry Salon. I had a message from our dear friend, Mercedes Yardley.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely lady. What an amazingly talented author as well.
She said she wanted to be here. She said, she's a Jasper Bark. Oh, he's such a darling. I wish I could be there, but I'm doing an interview with the horror podcast of the same name, or at the same time, rather. And she said, please send him my best regards and hello to me from her, too. So, yeah.
How lovely. How absolutely lovely.
Yeah.
And, of course, I send her loads of – I have to drop a little line myself when I get off air and just say thank you for that lovely message. And I hope her podcast interview went very well.
Yeah, and as she said, I loved being your guest. So, yes, Mercedes Yardley, I'd love for you to be here again because she's quite enchanting. And
she was, wasn't she?
Yeah, definitely. Well, she's so talented, young and beautiful, and yet she's just very, very charming. She's very, just talking with you, you know, she's very poised. And, yeah, I've got another question coming in from Becky Kyle, but first I'm going to bring in a caller. Somebody coming in here. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. This is Madame Perry, and I'm here with Jasper Bark. And
hey, this is Randy Blazak calling in from Portland, Oregon.
Randy Blazak, how you doing?
Hello. I'm enjoying the conversation, and I thought I'd call in with a more technical question because, you know, your guest is so prolific. I thought he might have some insight on this issue. So are you ready?
Okay.
Oh, are you ready, Jeff?
So, yeah. So the question is about the kind of state of the publishing world now and then how online and things like Kindle are sort of much more of a common way for people to access their literature. But the thing on the writer side that I'm sort of challenged about is that when you have something that's available online, you can constantly edit that work. So I had a novel out a few years ago, and there's another one coming out, and the Kindle version is a little bit different than the print version because after it was out for a little bit, I kind of went back and fixed a few things. And I'm just wondering, you know, from an – I don't know if there's a writer ethic or, you know, a way that things should be done. If that – I'm just wrestling with the notion that a book now – can technically never be finished, and the person who reads it when it first comes out may have a different experience than the person who reads it a year later because of the ability to go in and wordsmith. So I'm wondering if you've ever wrestled with that notion of going back and kind of tinkering with things once they're out, especially when you have so many different pieces out there. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And I'm reminded of a quote by Oscar Wilde, who said that that works of art are never really finished, they're only just abandoned. And I am a great one for rewriting. In fact, I love rewriting. The difference between when I was a performer and when I was a writer, if I was a performer, I was up on stage. No matter how good I was, there was always bits of my performance that I didn't like, but I could never go back and do that performance ever again. Once it was done, and no matter how good bits of it were, I could never fix the bits that weren't. The thing about being a writer is I can constantly go back and tinker with my manuscript. And sometimes, I swear, editors have driven across continents to beat me over the head and drag my manuscript out of my hands in time for a deadline. That's one of the great things about a deadline, is when you have to finally put down a work and get on with something else. So every writer, every time you pick up a book, particularly the first things I had published were mass market paperbacks, and some of them, one or two of them, are really poorly proofed as well. There's one in which the person they paid to proof it was obviously blind and probably completely illiterate, and probably was doing it locked inside a burlap sack while dropped in the bottom of an ocean, because they put more mistakes in there than there was in the original manuscript. I still cry every time I walk past a shelf in a bookshelf and see it there for sale, thinking, oh. So, yes, you do wrestle with this. Everybody wants to. The wonderful thing about writing is that you want to continually improve the text that you've created.
Right.
Inevitably speaking, though, eventually you sort of have to end your love affair. Going back and tinkering with your work is a great idea, and there's always things you can see to improve it, and I agree. But eventually, it's a little bit like sleeping with that ex-girlfriend stroke ex-boyfriend. It is kind of fun, and the breakup sex is absolutely marvelous, and you can have all these little fantasies about what might have been, but eventually you have to admit that relationship is not going anywhere. It's time to brush yourself off and start again. And it's the kind of same thing with novels. You've only got so many years on this planet. You've probably got at least 20 novels already in your mind that you must get around to writing someday. And that list will only continue to grow, just like your list, your to-be-read pile. There's also the to-be-written pile that backs up on your in your bottom drawer and on your hard drive. And the more time you spend tinkering with the works that are out there, the less time you can spend actually creating new works. And in a way, sometimes the best way to fix your old books is, or the mistakes you made in your old books, is not to make those mistakes in your next book, is to write something better the next time. So all I can really do eventually is go, that was the best I could do at that time, given those circumstances and that deadline. Occasionally it's nice when a book is bought by a new publisher and you think, oh, I could tinker with it. But sometimes it is best just to leave one alone and think, you know, that there are new things to be written, and I can improve on what I did with the next thing I write. So that's kind of my...
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of writers are slightly neurotic, so you just are always thinking about that sentence or that word or that character, and you just want to go back. But I think it's good. So letting go is always a good lesson in life. Letting go of people, letting go of seasons, you know. So I think letting go of a manuscript and letting it exist in the world, it's probably not always an easy thing, but probably psychologically is better for future work.
That's the only approach I've really found to get around it, because we are neurotic, and you will wake up in cold sweats in the middle of the night with your partner going, what, and you can't actually even admit that what you're sweating about is the misplacing of a comma.
Definitely.
But it will plague you. Oh, no, I didn't. Oh, you know, and every time I can't pick up a book that I've written without spotting something really dreadful that I could just kick myself for. But it's done.
Yeah, that helps. That helps. I feel like I've been in a therapy session.
Well, you're most welcome for that. And the nice thing is, well, the nice thing and also the rotten thing about writing is the majority of your readers never notice. And it's nice that they don't notice because they don't recognize just what a mistake you've made. And sometimes it's unfortunate they notice because they don't see how much you labored over something.
Right. Well, thanks for that. That gives me some good motivation to just sort of focus on the new one. I have a new one coming out in about a month. So I'm still
What's it called?
Sort of
Tell
laboring over the last. It's called The Dream Police. It's a sequel to The Mission of the Sacred Heart. So there is an entry in Wikipedia now for music fiction that I'm listed in, so I'm very happy to have a genre that I'm associated with. So working on this sort of concept of the rock novel, of taking your favorite music or your favorite albums and turning it into literature. For those of us that grew up listening to record albums and just sat in a room listening to a record side one and side two and imagining what all the songs meant. So this book is about lucid dreaming. Couple characters that get wrapped up in lucid dreaming as a way of fixing, kind of like we're talking about, going back and fixing old text, fixing moments in their lives, as well as, you know, going and seeing the Beatles at the Cavern and all the places that they want to go in their dreams. They really want to kind of fix the things that they screwed up in their lives through this dreamscape. So it's a little bit more David Lynchy than my last book, but I'm really excited about it. So it'll be out soon.
That sounds great. And it also sounds as well like the lucid dreaming is a metaphor for your own approach to writing. It's like that.
I didn't realize that until I made this phone call.
But that does sound... I'm always fascinated by lucid dreaming. I've only ever done it once or twice. And I woke up feeling in an incredibly... I woke up feeling slightly reborn, and this big, both times it ever happened to me, had this big rosy glow all around me, like for the rest of the day. That's kind of very difficult to explain. I felt really comfortable and really kind of quite happy and almost glowing. And I didn't, it was almost kind of like a weird religious experience. That time when I actually woke up within my dream and thought, wow, I'm lucid dreaming. I could do anything.
Yeah, I mean, when it happens, it's very exhilarating because it takes a little bit of practice, and so when you can pull it off, and there are people who just sort of do it on a nightly basis, which is amazing to me. But when you do it, it's like a drug. I mean, it's sort of like you want to experience it all the time, but it takes a bit of luck and a lot of practice.
Yeah, I've certainly not been able to master it except by accident. But yeah, that does sound fascinating. And I love the idea as well of because as creative individuals, you're always very often very passionate about more than one creative pursuit. But sometimes you may not have any talent in that area. I love music. I worked for many years as a music journalist. And interviewed some incredibly famous musicians, and as a stand-up, I did an awful lot of comparing for rock concerts and things. But I have no music talent whatsoever at all, and no ability to make music in any way. So it's always kind of quite cool to almost transpose the feelings you get from a record and try and put that in some creative pursuit you can do.
Yeah, that's sort of exactly what these books are about. I mean, the first one was kind of about the issue of suicide and why it's ultimately so hard to kill yourself, which I guess is not always funny. But, you know, part of the answer to that comes from the joy of music and wanting to hear the next great song. And I was just sort of channeling. I mean, there is a sort of a constant theme of music through both of these stories, and you're right. I mean, you're trying to take this thing that the inarticulate speech of the heart, as Van Morrison once referred to it, and take the feeling and put it down into word. And so it is a great way of. I mean, I'm the same way. I worked in the music field, and I have zero music talent. And but this is sort of my way of tapping into the stream of consciousness. I had a great, I got to work with some great people too, including I did a little bit of work with you too, and I lived in Ireland.
Superb.
And had a great conversation with Bono one time about the Irish muse and the notion that there's sort of this flowing river of creativity that you can just step into and let it take you where it will. So whether it's James Joyce or Van Morrison or, you know, a jazz musician, they just sort of step into the flow and let it go. And it, just thinking about that's something that both musicians and writers can do, was just, you know, opened a huge door of just, you know, sitting in front of a blank page or a blank screen and just letting it carry you wherever it's going to carry you. And then at the end, you know, sometimes you end up with something that's dreadful and nightmarish, and some, although that's what you write is dreadful and nightmarish, you want it to be dreadful and nightmarish, but you know, something that you can be proud of or something that you'll try over again, but you just sort of would step into the stream and let it go. It just gives everybody permission to give it a go. I think
I think you're right, absolutely right.
Definitely.
Well, thanks very much, I appreciate it. I'm going to enjoy the rest of the conversation.
Well,
Annie,
thank you
and very much for your call.
I'm so glad you're on, Randy. And for people listening to, Randy also has a great blog. It's called WatchingTheWheelsDad.net. And it's a subtitle, Feminist Fatherhood. And if you keep up with the news, how could you not keep up with the news these days? But your post for today is they're all good, but it's an especially good one to read.
Thanks. Yeah, it's in wake of the shooting in Oklahoma and the issue of white privilege, which is something a lot of us should talk more about. So that's it.
So, yeah, it's called Owning White Privilege.
I will go and check that out, Randy.
Thank you.
Please,
I'd be honored.
Please do. And, Randy, thank you so very much. And, Randy, I'd love for you to be a guest on Madame Perry Salon sometime.
Hey, you know where to find me.
Well, yes, I think I do. Yeah. And I know your friends, too, like your you know, Ray Ray. Africa and people like that. So, all right. Thank you so very much, Randy. And one more thing, Randy.
Take care.
Randy?
Yes.
I was going to say, while you're still here, one of my sponsors is Kimberly Klecka, and she writes children's books, and she has music to go along with them, and she has videos, and she wanted me to say that from tonight until the 21st through the 25th, one of her books is going to be, it's Alok's Cool Place in Outer Space. It's going to be free, so you can go on to Amazon. I'll have the link up for it already up on my page, and you can get a free one for your lovely daughter, Cozy.
Fantastic. She needs a new story in this house. Cool. Thanks very
much. All right. Thanks so much, dear.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you, Randy.
Such
hey.
A cool guy. Good writer. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we've got, let me start right now. In case, do you need to get a glass of water or something? Or
I have
a glass of water
right next to me. Why was I
check
standing particularly parched?
No. But I have a couple of, lovely sponsors tonight, and I'll need to play their ads because they're kind enough to help me stay here and keep bringing cool people like you on, right? Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So
well, I'll get quickly get naked and jump into the sauna. How about that? And I'll be right back. All
really,
nice
I'd
and kind
that.
Of warmed and sweaty.
Yeah. And check on the gerbils while you're there.
I will do. So I don't
all
keep
right,
them in the sauna.
You. Okay. All right, if you were listening last night, you know I mentioned the film project that's doing a crowdfunder, or excuse me, raising money on Kickstarter. It's called Corkscrew the Movie. And I'm going to let you know about them. They have some fantastic perks if you make a donation of any size, and I'm going to let them tell you about it right now.
My name is Chris, and I'm the director of a new feature film called Corkscrew. We have a Kickstarter campaign we need your help with. This story is based on true events, which makes it all the more intriguing. Following the death of his wife, Robert moves into an apartment complex to rebuild his life, but finds more is haunting him than just personal demons. If you love indie films, then you are a perfect fit to partner with us on Kickstarter. We have a ton of bonus gifts if you decide to contribute to our campaign. To visit our Kickstarter page, type in corkscrewmovie.com.
Did you know our pets are exposed to toxic metals and harmful chemicals daily? Today's pet lives a lifestyle which contributes to a sluggish metabolism, where they're unable to remove toxins and eliminate fat. Exposure to toxins can injure our pet's immune and gastrointestinal systems and lower defenses against infections and fungal diseases. So our pets actually lose their vibrance and become more susceptible to illnesses. Many pet foods contain toxic metals at alarming levels. Mercury, arsenic, cadmium, and uranium are all found in high levels in pet food today. There's pesticides, like toxic lawn and garden chemicals, over-the-counter flea and tick products, and topical treatments. Antibiotics and steroids help, but many times symptoms come back worse, killing all intestinal bacteria, both good and bad, further jeopardizing our pet's health. Well, there's something you can do to improve your pet's health significantly. A clean and detoxified body is your pet's foundation for good health. Now there's Detoxipet, an all-in-one, one-of-a-kind formulation containing 15 complex synergistic elements for complete pet detoxification, while also ensuring good gastrointestinal and immune health. Simply sprinkle it on your pet's food and watch them thrive. It supports detoxification enzyme activity in the liver and other organs with ingredients like turmeric root and milk thistle, while supporting important essential vitamins like vitamin C, glutathione, and alpha-lipoic acid. It also contains special ingredients that strengthen and support your pet's gastrointestinal and immune systems, needful ingredients like high-quality probiotics, colostrum, spirulina, and high ORAC fruit powder. Detoxipet is designed so that your pet can thrive in today's environment, and it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch your pet thrive, or your money back. Order now.
All right, yes, you know, Madam Perry and many of my friends are pet lovers, dog lovers. Do you have a dog, Jasper?
I don't have a dog. My mother-in-law, who lives just around the corner from me, used to have a lovely dog, a mongrel, but she's gotten a little bit too old to look after it, and we don't have the time. So it's unfortunately gone to live with my brother and sister-in-law over in Ireland, where she's having a wonderful time, but she's much missed. I do have two cats, though. Fascinating thing about cats and dogs is dogs will spend all their time worrying about whatever they can do to best please their master. Cats spend all their time wondering about how they can better take control of your mind so they can bend you to their every whim. And you know, when you don't do exactly what they want when they jump, they give you that, I thought I had you better trained. Look, that scowl.
Well.
So, yeah, I think dogs are kind of quite, cats are quite anarchic. They don't really kind of follow orders or kind of work on kind of hierarchies. Whereas dogs are very, they're very loyal creatures, aren't they? I think most dogs would vote Republican.
Well, I don't know, except for, you know, I'd always had bigger dogs, you know, shepherds, malamutes, and so forth. But you know what? I know the, you know, the corgis, you know, queen, et cetera, but when somebody talked me into getting a corgi, and then I had some more, I had four, do you remember the movie, the black and white movie with George Sanders called, I think it's Children of the Damned?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So when the kids, when I had at one time four corgis, I didn't mean to, they just made their own. I didn't mean to have four at one time. When I had four corgis living with us, I felt like I was the teacher that all the children were to stay with. You know, the kids that were just
so
kind of blazed around.
You had to
build
a wall around your mind.
Yeah,
they would line up in front of you and just stare at you.
Yeah, yeah, with a dead eye beam right to your brain, trying to put it, get treats now, you know, pet me now. And that's what I do. I felt like that was my job, like a personal assistant, like that teacher. Hey, Jasper, guess who just walked in?
Who?
Dear friend of my best friend, my BFF, and pal of yours, the beloved. Well, she's a host.
Yeah.
She's much beloved, but she's all. What'd you say? She's also the host of Everything Relationships here on Blog Talk Radio, my friend Kenya Colbert. Kenya, welcome.
Hello, Kenya.
Hello, Jasper. How are you?
I'm very well.
Fine.
I'm still slightly hung up on what Jennifer said about the corgis, because it makes me think, do you think you might have uncovered a secret conspiracy? Do you think the Queen is actually under the control of her corgis? In which case, do you think my country, the UK, is actually run by dogs? It has literally gone to the dogs.
But you know, if you read a lot of, you know, biographies and such, like I do, you know, there are some who believe that in the last few years of Reagan's reign, that you know he was highly influenced by Thatcher.
Yes,
your Margaret Thatcher. Yeah, because they were so tight, and I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, remember this. Like I said, I've read a lot of books. You know, Kenya will tell you I've read a lot of books about different people in the royal family going back a few generations. And I read that although Queen Elizabeth never once prepared even a glass of milk or a cup of tea or anything for Charles, that she prepared each corgi's food herself. Each, because one, well, this one likes more gravy, and this one likes less, but likes more dry food.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So maybe they have got her under their control. We just don't know about it.
I'm saying, if she can't give her old child, you know, a glass of water, but she takes the time out of her royal day to go out and make each the dog food separately in different bowls, what does that tell you? Conspiracy theory? I don't know. I think it's going to be.
Yes.
Very convincing dogs. That's what I can think.
And Kenya, you know, I had one corgi that was
damned.
I had one that was just like Kenya's father. In fact, I named him after her father, and he was a stubborn.
Did.
They don't give an inch. And in fact, he used to be. I remember
That's
seeing one.
That was the truth. Really, she did name him after my father, and it was right on. It was right on point. It was scary. scary.
He even tried
did
to
your father
Kenya's
ever find out?
Oh, yeah.
And what was the question?
I said, did your father ever find out that you'd named one of your corgis?
My father was very impressed and loved it.
Absolutely. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, because the dog was very stubborn, very hard-headed, you know, kind mm-hmm. of set in his ways.
Very clever.
He was very clever, very determined to get what he wanted in this life, and he figured out ways to get it. Just like my father, amazing.
Well, you have to take your hat off to the hound then, don't you, basically?
You really do. Actually,
yeah.
You do.
I admire that about any species, any creature.
And in fact,
yeah,
even though Benny liked to get petted, when he met Kenya's ex-husband,
mm-hmm.
he ran that man back into his truck. That man's in a truck. Benny's a corgi. He's about what? How far off the ground? About ankle length. And,
mm-hmm.
and her ex just back in his truck screaming, "Benny ain't never liked me. Benny ain't never liked me. He always hated me." This is a dog.
Was your ex-husband as popular with your father?
Not at all, but he was a dog lover. He loved pets, but this pet just understood that we don't like you. So he didn't like you.
Big Benny and little Benny were like two, like one soul and two different bodies. And no, because he knew that, yeah, Kenya said, "Yeah, Benny, oh, I never disliked Thurman." And yeah, right, Dad. But, and I remember a TV show I saw once, British show called Drop the Dead Donkey. Do you remember that show?
Yes, I do, actually.
And one of the episodes I saw was after, remember some years back, maybe 20, 25 years, someone had breached the wall and had entered, a burglar invader entered the Queen's bedroom. Do you remember that?
I vaguely remember that, yes.
Okay, so in this show, it's about a newspaper, you know, what's like a newspaper office or a magazine. So somebody in the reporters decide to go ahead and see if they could recreate that, how easy it would be to get in the Queen's bedroom. And so
mm-hmm.
they've got the camera going along behind the reporter, and he's outside. Saying, "Well, what's going on now?" And the guy says, "Well, we've just dismantled their security system here at the castle." And then that takes a shot, and it's just a corgi passed out like they had knocked it out. Okay, but we're gonna get to your other new books, and we got someone else who's just come on into Madame Perry's salon. This is Madame Perry with Jasper Bark and Kenya Colbert. Step in and identify
Hello.
Yourself. Hey,
oh,
is this my funny friend?
It is. How are you?
Hey, fine. Is this Glenn Tickle?
Yeah. Hello,
hi,
everyone.
Mr. Tickle. Hi, Mr. Tickle.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing
hi,
well.
Hi, Mr. Tickle. Jasper, this is our friend Glenn Tickle. He is a stand-up comic. He lives in New Jersey?
That's the one.
Philadelphia. And he's on
hey,
tour
Glenn.
Right now.
Good to meet you.
You as well.
Also a
yeah,
filmmaker?
I'm out driving around doing college shows. I'm home
how's
this
that?
Week and I have to head back out next week. It's good. It's a lot of time away, but the shows are going well. So.
Oh, that's good. So what are students like in your part of the world? Because in my part of the world, students are remarkably lazy. And I've done gigs in student bars where there's like... the bar next door is absolutely heaving with students lying around spending all their college loans on beer. And then the next room, we're kind of putting on free stand-up with some quite big celebrity names. And there's like four people sitting there looking at each other thinking, where's the beer? Do you have similar experiences?
Yeah, basically, more or less. I know when I was a student, I was very lazy. I stayed an extra year at school to further put off having to really do anything.
Always a good plan.
But a lot the shows I'm doing are like on-campus events, and some of them, like, students are required to go, I found out. Some of them have, like, an honors program where the
How
students
savage.
In the honors program have to go to a certain number of social events per semester, like just to make sure they don't just hang out and do work all the time.
Wow. Okay.
So the one show I did, it was like pretty clearly a third full of those students.
Wow.
It worked out great for me, but yeah, I can.
Well, as long as they pay. Well,
exactly.
All right. So Glenn, while you're on here, you know, we've already talked about Jasper's. He's got three new books out, and one is The Final Cut. If you haven't read this yet, you'll understand it because, you know, you're also a filmmaker. And
yeah, that's what I went to school for. That's what took me 6 years to get out of college.
Really? I'm about to go back for a master's in filmmaking. But anyway, also there's two more, Run to Ground and Bed of Crimson Joy. But that reminds me, before we say what the books are about or have Jasper describe them, if you would tell us your own little story about horror and a baby. You know, it's what I'm talking about with your daughter and the baby after she's had the thing clipped under. Tell
oh,
us
yeah.
Story.
My daughter
Jasper will
terrifies
get it.
Me. She's, mm-hmm. she's three now. Do you have kids, Jasper?
I have two daughters.
It's a nightmare, right? Like I only have the one. But when my daughter was 4 months, I got woken up in the middle of the night by the sound of her crying and the sound of my wife pretending to be asleep. So I had to go check on the baby. And I look in her crib and her face is covered in blood. So I start panicking. But I remember it's fine because a few days before that, she had to have surgery. She had her tongue tie corrected. It was sticking out too far. And I say surgery, but, like, literally we brought her to the regular doctor. And he's like, let me see that baby for a second. And he just snipped and was done. Like, he did it with scissors.
Wow.
You could do it. You could do it now. Don't do it.
Oh, my God.
But that's like, all it was. Oh, just so you know, like, over the next couple of days, might be some bloody saliva. It's nothing to panic about. So that's all it was. And I calmed down. And my daughter's still crying. I'm like, oh, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. And then I pick her up to, like, kind of rock her and get her back to sleep. And as soon as I pick her up, she stops crying, and she starts laughing. And I'm like, nah, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen. That's some nightmare stuff, baby. Don't do that. Do not laugh with blood on your face. That is horrifying.
So she's projectile vomiting blood and then laughing at you. Did she start speaking in Latin?
Exactly.
If she could talk at that point, probably. Yeah, it was
Glenn Pickle and his little seed of Chucky there.
Yeah. As a parent, picking up your child at the middle of the night in covered in blood, operations or not, that is like a heart-stopping moment.
Definitely.
Yeah,
I totally feel your pain there.
Yeah, it was horrible. Like, I'm glad she's fine now. I wouldn't do a joke about it, but it was frightening at the time.
We're glad she's fine, too. So now, tell us about while you and Glenn are here, Jasper, tell us about the other two books.
As The Final Cut. Run to Ground is an over the top piece of folk horror. It's set in a graveyard, and something quite unspeakable is possessing the ground at the feet of the groundskeeper, a guy who's on the run from his responsibilities. He's on the run from fatherhood. He's on the run from debts. He's hiding out, trying to go off the grid. And now he finds himself on the run from some particularly nasty entities that have possessed the ground at his feet. And they're murdering everyone else in the graveyard. And there's literally nowhere he can walk, nowhere he can run, and absolutely nowhere he can hide that they can't get to. He can't get out of the graveyard, and he can't go anywhere within the graveyard. And before the night's out, he discovers that these entities are linked not only to his former misdemeanors, not only to a particularly unspeakable fetish that he has, but also they're linked to an ancient heresy. It's the same heresy that's featured in The Final Cut, and once again it starts at the dawn of time and runs to the end of the world as we know it. And it is like, again, it's got an ending you won't see coming. It's like a giant, great, horrific, shaggy dog story. But this is more of a shaggy grave story.
Oh my gosh.
They certainly won't be basing an episode of Scooby Doo in it, I can promise you that.
It's also got a great these all have great covers. But if I could read the zine, the magazine Ginger Nuts of Horror and their review of it, and I know you've read this, Jasper, but I like the way he says I'm just going to pick out a few lines of this. Run to Ground by Jasper Bark is a book that wears its pulp horror roots with great pride. And it talks about the guy, the character, and all this. And then he says, Bark is a sick man. That's you. Jasper Bark is a sick man. Not content with giving the characters of this book a nasty death, he has also given McLeod one sick personality trait. I was genuinely chilled at the perverse things that he got up to. Where he gets these ideas from, I have no idea, but I'm glad he does.
It's basically, I think it's just because I can't afford therapy, so I just have to write these things out. I can't afford a really bad drugs problem, so I just have to write instead.
I'm afraid I'm going to read the book, and then when I get to the perverted stuff, I'll be like, that's not that bad. That's not pretty tame.
I can guarantee it will raise an eyebrow or two. You'll go, what? Seriously, no, he hasn't gone there. Seriously, what? on air, I will say that if you don't have that reaction, then I will reimburse you for the cost of the book.
Really? Oh, my God.
Challenge accepted.
All right. Kenya, we're witnesses. We heard it.
I heard it too.
The most milquetoast guy. Like I raise a lot of eyebrows all the time. I'm pretty sure it's a safe bet for you.
And so the last line is: "Run to Ground is a twisted tale of the unexpected that delights the reader with its playful use of perverse horror." There you go.
Ooh.
The fascinating thing. About that was as well. The guy who wrote that review is called Jim McLeod, and he is an incredible proponent for horror. His website is absolutely excellent, and he's loved by most people in the horror community. And he looks a little bit like a slightly taller, kind of more tank-like version of groundskeeper Willie. but a little more handsome, obviously. Because he's so beloved in the horror world, a lot of the authors got together last year for one of the main fantasy conventions and put together a little book of stories with him as the lead character called Jim McLeod Must Die. And I wrote the original version of Run to Ground was written, and it was put in an anthology. There was only one copy published, and we just gave him the copy, so only he has it. And it was a bit like a thank you for everything he's done. So this book is I've slightly expanded the original story. So he was reviewing a book in which he was the lead character.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
That's a great gift.
Really is.
And Bed of Crimson Joy.
I have one that's not quite so scary, though, Jasper. Can you do one for me that's kind of like with the humorous side of you, like with your limericks? I still remember those. I like funny stuff. I don't like scary stuff, but
well, he has a science fiction book.
Yeah, I've done stuff that's a bit spooky. And kind of more atmospheric than necessarily horrific. And I've done a lot of humor stuff as well.
I know. I've read some. I absolutely have. That's how I know this. That's what I'm saying. But see, I guess what I'm saying is that I'm looking for my own story like you wrote for him that is just for him and he gets the only book. I want one like that too. My own.
Give me a bit of time, Kenya, and I'll see what I can come up with.
I'm just kidding. I love you. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I am. That's a pretty cool gift, though. That is a gift. A cool gift. Pretty cool.
He's a very cool guy. Is Jim, the guy behind Ginger Nuts of Horror.
Very good.
And Bed of Crimson Joy.
Yes,
which,
Bed of Crimson
is the last
Joy.
Book.
Yes.
The idea for that came to me, actually, because we have two very, very lovely elderly neighbours where we live. They own the little cottage right next door to ours. And whenever we go away on holiday, they're such lovely people, they can't do enough for everyone in the community. And when we go away on holiday, they always they feed our cats and water our plants and look after our house. And unfortunately, I have got one of those slightly deranged minds that goes to places that it shouldn't really go to. And whereas most people have the kind of cut-off switch, I seem to be wired without that. When they kind of assembled me in whatever strange laboratory, they forgot to put that cut-off switch in. As we were driving away, and I was waving on holiday one time, and I was waving goodbye to them, and they were standing, I had this sudden thought, what about if, now they've just waved goodbye to me, the minute our car turns around the bend, they dash into our bedroom and start going at it like rabbits on our bed, on our freshly under sheets. And it was like, where did that image come from? What is wrong with you? But then, of course, unfortunately, I don't have that off switch that most people have. And so it's playing over and over. I'm thinking, this is seriously freaking me out. What on earth is happening? And I thought, okay, if this is freaking you out, then there's a story there.
That's
how the Bed of Grimms and Joy starts, with an elderly couple who are looking up someone's thing. They turn up in a bedroom, and in the middle of this room is this huge, ornate bed, which is... all the carvings on it are completely strange, erotic carvings. And the tapestries show scenes of almost impossible orgies going on. And the minute they touch the bed, it has this strange aphrodisiac effect on them.
Wow.
And they find themselves rutting. And then events take a very sinister turn. And it's a very long, slow build to a quite unfortunate end.
Oh, I can read that book. I like the way it starts already. I'm already in. You caught my attention from the beginning, Casper. I don't care how it ends. I love the way it begins.
And what do you like about it, Kane? The fact that people have like a secret life, or the fact that there's a lot of, a lot of getting down going on, people doing the wild thing? What is it?
Yeah, I like that wild thing part. I like that. But
I think she likes ornate carvings.
Mm. I was about to say, there's something about the tapestry of the the blanket, and then you have these things that are going on in the background that maybe they don't know that's happening yet, and they probably can't even explain it to themselves, but they're so caught up in the moment. I just want to get in that moment with them and just come in that room and see what's going on. I could read that book easily. I'm getting
fantastic.
That.
Well, don't stop yourself. Act on that urge. Go and read that book right now.
By the way, we have another visitor here in Madame Perry Salon. Hi, this is Madame Perry with Jasper Bark, Kenya Colbert, Glenn Pickle, and please come in and introduce yourself.
Hi, it's Andrea. How are you doing, Madame Perry?
Great, Andrea. This is Andrea Robinson from the West Coast.
Hello.
That's
there.
Right.
Hello.
I'm listening to your demented ideas.
Thank you so much.
I got into it. I like it. The horror, the rutting, the whole thing, you know. Great stuff. I was looking. Oh, yeah. So where do you think all this stuff comes from?
That's a very difficult question to answer, and in some ways it's
spicy
almost like
food kind of late at night or something.
Looking that gift horse in the mouth. So maybe it's kind of like a genetic flaw somewhere in my makeup. I think it comes from the fact that I have a slightly out of control imagination and always had. And as a kid, I had a slightly hallucinatory childhood because I was never quite certain if things were real or if I was ever imagining them. And I was quite old before I kind of just thought, well, it doesn't really matter. And so my imagination is just always overplaying all the time. And writing is just a kind of way of almost caging that beast or just doing something else with it.
Well, thank
it.
God you found a way to do something with it.
Something productive.
So did you get into a lot of trouble? Well, I would hope so. I mean, did you get into a whole lot of trouble as a child? Because one has to wonder.
The simple answer is yes. I got into a lot of trouble as a child. I got into a lot of trouble as a young adult. I'm still quite often in trouble. I rarely get out of trouble. Yes. Again, fortunately, with a runaway imagination and not having most people before they're about to do something that's probably ridiculously stupid or possibly kind of life-threateningly idiotic, have that part of their brain that just whispers in their head just before they're about to kind of leap naked over the chasm. Is this a good idea? Mine has a delayed reaction. So it's usually after I've done it, my mind then goes, was that a good idea? By which point, I just have to live with the consequences. You know, I could probably not, no. But where were you? Where were you when I was about to do it? You were nowhere to be seen. Thanks for asking me now.
Well, the trouble with it is, if somebody did imagine you doing it, it was too late. I mean, you probably already did it.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that was the problem.
So occasionally it works out for me, you know, and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah, sometimes I'm lying at the bottom of a gully, you know, surrounded by the hairy, naked bikers, thinking, well, why did I do this again? And other times I'm picking up a Pulitzer Prize, thinking, how did that happen?
This is a shame. Oh, my God, you know. It's a can of worms.
Another question.
You
know, I was going to say, if you go to his website, jasperbark.com, and read his story, and he says he's a child of gypsies, and yet I wonder, were you born to gypsies, or did they have to become gypsies to kind of stay on the run, to stay kind of like a step ahead of whatever trouble
Yeah, which
there?
Came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, they do come from gypsy stock. Kind of, you know, Romany gypsies, and my ancestors were those slightly dodgy people that turned up and kind of fixed pans things for you and tried to read your palm and palm looking heather off on you and all of that. So that they were always probably slightly one step ahead of the law themselves.
Probably.
I love it.
So I'm one of the sensitive people that I could never watch a horror movie or read a scary book until I went to film school, at which point I was involved in making horror movies, and I can only tell you that the hilarity behind the special effects was so funny that I've never been scared of a horror movie since, because we were like, you know, pumping hearts bleeding in our hands and making blood in these huge vats, you know, and throwing it all around. It was just so hysterical. I've never been involved in anything so fun. So
I think that's part of the reason that I write. And the surprising thing is because I'm known for writing stuff that's quite scary, and people do have nightmares and do ask me where on earth does all this come from. It has a very dark sense of humor running throughout it. you know, I've always had a sense of humor. Thankfully, it's possibly one of my own only saving grace is that and marrying the right woman.
For you.
And yes, definitely kept me in hand. Kept me clothed sometimes
awesome.
As well.
That's awesome, but, too. That's a good thing.
That is a very good thing, thankfully for me. But the sense, a lot of nothing I do is done without a sense of humor, no matter how dark on the surface. But secondly, also, I think people who write horror scare very, very easy. When I watch, my wife can't stand horror movies, but my eldest daughter loves them. She's 15, about to turn 16, and we watch horror movies together. And I'm the one hiding behind the sofa, behind a cushion, and jumping with every single start. And she's the one rolling her eyes. My wife came in to find me crying. What is you're supposedly the crown prince of British horror, and look at you, like a little girl. I'm standing behind my daughter going, what? So I think part of the reason I get involved in scary stuff is because I'm very easily scared. It's something to kind of, a lot of people who create this stuff are easily scared, so they find it quite easy to to, and if you can't scare yourself, you can't scare a reader. So if you find a way to scare yourself, you can find a way to scare a reader. And it's another way of controlling that fear and facing up to that fear and confronting it, really. And having a safe place to do that, which is really what a horror movie is about, you know, because eventually you can put down a scary book, you can put down a horror movie, and it's like going on a roller coaster. You've entertained yourself. Oh my God! You know, you go through that thing. Your heart beats, your pulse races, your armpits get all clammy, and then you step off and you go, "Ha, ha, ha! I survived."
Yeah, right.
And you can face all those fears in a safe environment, which is what I kind of also hope I do for people who read my work, even if they're, you know, I push them a little bit far sometimes.
If I could just read something to you from another thing, from it's also from Ginger Nuts of Horror. But I think this was written by Kit Power, and it was written, the title is Bed of Crimson Joy by Jasper Bark, but it says, Mr. Bark has been on an absolute tear lately with a novel, The Final Cut, and novella Run to Ground, released and with Crystal Lake Publishing, and a novella, Bed of Crimson Joy, from Nightwatch Press. And it says, Bed of Crimson Joy is, in many ways, vintage Bark. We've got inexplicable supernatural occurrences, brilliantly realized relationships, and explicit sexual content. What strongly differentiates this story from the others, for me, is the tone. Whereas The Final Cut was a roller coaster of genre and mood, and Run to Ground, a brilliant comedy-horror mashup underpinned by a Barker-esque mythology, Bed of Crimson is an altogether more melancholy affair. Now, I think it's even cool that there is vintage Bark and Barker-esque mythology. To me, that means you are somebody.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That was very lovely of you to write, wasn't it?
All. Yeah.
It does.
Very nice, madame.
Oh, thank you, dear. So, but yeah, I mean, I didn't write it. I'm just reading it, but that's what it says in, from Ginger Nuts of Horror. And Jasper Bark remains almost a paradoxical writer, at once shamelessly focused on these, I think it means to be, is perinally, could be perinaturally, juvenile fascinations of sex and extreme horror. Yet, also writing with a rare, perennially, okay, this is perennial, well, whatever. Yet also writing with the rare intelligence, both emotional and intellectual, with the true storyteller's ability to present real people unflinchingly and without sentimentality or judgment. So, Mr. Bark.
That was very sweet of you to say, isn't it? Obviously, it's so nice when people write things like that, because obviously that's what I intend to do. And also, on top of all this, I work in horror, which is a kind of a schlocky genre. It's only really a step and a half above pornography in most people's kind of like eyes. And I kind of understand that. And it's like, you know, you're the badass of the literary world. So you're not really allowed into the nice places to sit with the nice people and have the nice literary conversations because you do that big horror thing. But
exactly.
But it's kind of, you're eating, you know, with the kind of, you know, with the kitchen staff, really, when it comes to any award ceremonies.
Oh,
but
oh, no.
Poor baby.
It kind of, partly there's, there's also, you can kind of wear that sort of stigma with a bit of pride sometimes, and I think horror writers do. But also, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have ambitions that are equal to those people who get all the nice literary awards, that you're not don't have something to say, and that you're not there. In many, many ways, you're drawn to horror because it's the best way to say what you want to say about the human condition. And there's a lot that can be said, you know. And in many ways, particularly, you know, with the world in its current state, it's difficult to match the level of terror that you can feel turning on the news these days with a simple story about imaginary creatures like werewolves or zombies. And so sometimes one of the best ways to respond to the world when it is in quite a scary state, and we are quite panicked, is, again, by facing up to those fears and almost putting a safe place to look at those fears and disempower those fears. And horror fiction's actually quite a good way of doing that.
Yeah. I love the walk.
I think you're right.
He's right.
You know that, Jasper. I was going to say I love The Walking Dead because it's not real, but it kind of, it's all about the survival.
Exactly.
If something happens, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How will you react if that happens?
Totally.
Mm.
Totally. And it's even the world in which they're living is only a couple of steps away from where we are. You can still see
exactly.
lots of parallels.
Yes,
and it's
exactly
just
right.
ramped up a little bit extra. So kind of, and by ramping up the kind of tension a little bit more, it just throws everything to slightly more sharp relief. And it lets you say things and explore things that say, if those people were just on the run in a war-torn area, if there was a civil war, for instance, broken out where they're living, it wouldn't have the same effect as putting them up against monsters. And the fact is that the monsters that they're up against are former human beings that
mm-hmm.
have lost
mm-hmm.
their humanity. And are
yeah.
given to that kind of intense levels of violence. And the thing that in a lot of great zombie apocalypse stories that's really, really key is the people who are left are doing their darndest to cling on to the last vestiges of their humanity because
exactly.
it's the only thing that separates them between them and the walking corpses.
Exactly. And some of those who are giving away that humanity are worse than the walking corpses.
But at the moment,
they
are in the Walking Dead.
Yeah, because they know
yeah,
they're
you go,
doing.
Who are the monsters?
Definitely doing. Exactly. Who are the monsters? Exactly. Exactly. Great
By the
point.
Way, in their book, in the final cut, there's all these. Mm-hmm. There is like an underpinning or woven stories of old mythology and gods and goddesses. And I have a question here from Becky Kyle. She's
mm-hmm.
an author and editor, and you know her recent book Fanny and Dice was about Euripides and what's the name? They escaped from Hades into the wild, wild west. And so she has a question
wow.
for you. How many eyes, it is a good book, how many eyes does Jasper Bark think that Cerberus has?
Oh, heavens. That's a tough one, because he's a many-headed dog. And it also depends on how old the telling of his mythology is, because he sometimes claimed to be a two-headed dog, which would mean he'd have four eyes. Those eyes are also supposed to be absolutely huge and deathly and very, very saucer-like. But in older depictions and occasionally in older statues, of Cerberus. He's also conflated with, I think it's pronounced the Chimera. Isn't that how you pronounce it? Not the Chimera.
Oh, yes.
Which is also like another many-headed being. So I think it's Cerberus has two heads, doesn't he? So four eyes, I think. But they're also huge, giant, great sorcerer eye, kind of like, and they're quite terrifying to look into, if I recall. Is this a trick question? Or do I win a Jeep now?
I was wondering, too.
Or
win a Jeep?
Actually, if I'm facing down Cerberus and trying to count his eyes, I'll kind of maybe stare him out, because it would be difficult. If I've got two eyes and he's got four, it's going to be hard to stare him out. He also was one of the guardians
right.
to the underworld, isn't he?
Glad it wasn't a corgi. See, people don't know how savage. They are little savages. They are thieves and savages.
They are.
I don't know, but we do have somebody else. I was about to. We have somebody else who's just entered Madame Perry's salon. My door guy, Mr. Sulu, must be taking a break somewhere. Maybe he's reading the final cut. Welcome to Madame Perry's salon. Who do we have here?
Well, hello, darling.
Hey. How you doing?
You don't know who this is?
Yes. Is that
Alan.
My sugar? Is that my Alan? Yes.
Yeah.
My sugar bear.
I am.
Hi,
Alan. Cackalacky.
Indeed.
You know my friend Kenya? She's in here.
Hey, Kenya. How are you, darling?
I am good. Good to hear you again. How are you
good
doing?
Good to hear you as well. I'm well.
Good, good, good. Well, welcome to the party.
Yay.
And he sounds close to sober tonight, too, but I think he'll be fun anyway. Alan Sugar, I'm so glad you're here. Yeah, so you know Kenya, but you don't know Glenn Tickle, the comedian, is in here. I'm trying to get him to Asheville. Also, Andrea Robinson, my filmmaking writing friend on the West Coast, and my guest of honor tonight, author and filmmaker and gerbil pimp, playboy, bon vivant, Jasper Bark.
Well, this is a house full. How's everyone?
Great.
I'm good, thank you.
Doing great.
So, are you
sorry
a fan of horror?
Sorry to be late to the party or interrupt. What's that, dear?
Are you a fan of horror movies, horror books?
Somewhat. I can be talked into it. Depends on how much I've had to drink. Which is true with most things.
It helps.
Fascinating enough, do you know there was a study recently in Sweden on people who watched horror movies, and they were trying to find correlations, what kind of linked them together, you know, if there was like something wrong with them mentally, if they were kind of quite depressed. And the only connection they found with people who watch horror movies an awful lot is that they had higher than normal sex drives.
Ooh.
Which kind of
normal
used to remind me, as a young kid visiting the video store with a date, and you'd always kind of sidle up to the kind of girly movies and you kind of say, do you want to watch Out of Africa or When Harry Met Sally? And when the girl rolled her eyes at you and walked straight over to the horror rack and picked up Evil Dead, you always kind of silently punched the edge.
Yes!
Yeah!
And apparently that would be the reason.
Well, but I guess I have a horror fan then.
I've been reading. I don't know if you've been listening, but I've been reading some of Jasper's reviews, especially from a magazine called Ginger Nuts of Horror, and they say he's a sick man, and shamelessly focused on juvenile fascinations of sex and extreme horror, and that's why I'm so delighted to have him here because he's just an absolute treasure for those reasons and more.
Oh wow!
Well, that's very nice of you to say.
Oh,
most people would think that was the reason never to invite me back, but so obviously I'm in good company.
Jasper, I think word's getting around town. Somebody else. Hey, Alan, could you just move over a little bit? We've got somebody else coming in. Move over a little closer to Kenya.
I'm going to make a little more room because I got to go put my 3-year-old to bed. But pleasure talking with everybody. Enjoy the rest of your night.
And you too, Alan. Thank you very much for dropping by.
Glenn, is that
you
putting the 3-year-old to bed? Thank God, I thought it was Alan. Okay.
Oh, sorry, Glenn.
Yeah.
Bye, Glenn.
All right.
See you.
Love you, Glenn.
Bye, friends.
Good night.
All
give
right,
all regards to your daughter.
All right. Good night, Glenn. All right. So, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon. Step right in.
Hi, this is Paula Limbaugh. I am. Hi. Yeah, I have a question for Jasper. Yes. Okay, I have a question for Jasper.
Yes.
Knowing what you know today in the business of writing, what do you wish you knew back when you were first starting out? Was there any type of advice you wish you would have had, anything that would have prepared you for what was coming ahead?
Probably stop jerking around and get writing more, you idiots. Stop. There was a wonderful quote from Joe Esterhaus, who was the guy who wrote Basic Instinct and a whole lot of things. If you're sitting at your desk masturbating, put your cock down and get back to writing. That's what I do sitting at my desk. But it's interesting. There's 101 ways you can always
probably
distract yourself.
I'm a writer's young man.
You're a cock. You do what you wish.
I wish I was. I wish I'd written more and gotten on to doing things more quickly than I did. I think I probably would have said to myself, "You're nowhere near as good as you think you are, but you're much better than you realize."
Oh, that's great!
Yeah, I think that's it. A lot of people lack the self-confidence. You know, you write and write, but you're afraid to let others see it and then hear what they're going to say about it. And, you know, when you're first starting out,
I totally agree.
Jump in.
And I think sometimes I needed, as an arrogant young man, to crawl out from under the crushing weight of my own ego. And I think as your ego inflates, and it is a very disabling thing when you've got a large ego, then your self-esteem withers in a little way. And you almost kind of need your ego to shrink a little bit and for your self-esteem and for your confidence to blossom, which is why you want the be-all and end-all. You want this amazing person you are on your mind because you've written nothing yet. Get over yourself. However, don't be so that your ego is only swelling as a safety mechanism, like one of those tiny little frogs that swell themselves up to kind of dissuade, you know, foxes and things from eating them, because your confidence is so small. You're better than you realize you are, but you're not as good as you think.
Right. That sounds right. I know. I think, too, you know, some people take to heart, you know, when they get these bad reviews. And it's like, you know, actually you can learn from those bad reviews. You should take them and welcome them and say, okay, you know, I mean, some reviews, yeah, they're crazy. But you know what I mean? It's just some there, you know, the criticism is like, okay, you know, maybe there is something I can change or maybe there is some way I can grow a little more. You know, when you're first starting out, there's always room for improvement, I think, and some people just don't realize that because, like you said, they have the inflated ego thinking, okay, yeah, I'm the best. And, you know, sometimes you have to be knocked down a little bit just to build yourself back up and say, okay, yeah, you can learn and get better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, could not agree more. And you do need that. And it's a constant lesson. Obviously, you have to keep learning it. But I do hope continue to improve as a writer, and if I have any type of increased success, that I will become more humble in the face of it. That's kind of what I rather hope.
Okay.
But yes, you need to get over yourself, and I needed to get over myself in a big way, but there you go. But hopefully I'm slightly over myself now.
and I want to say, I'm so delighted that you're here, Paula, for the other of you who some of you may know, but Paula is the marketing executive for Crystal Lake Publishing, which has published The Final Cut, Run to Ground, and some of Jasper's other book, as well as books by other people that have been guests on Madame Perry Salon. So very happy that you're here.
Paula, from a personal one-to-one basis, it's never a good idea to address your critics, they always say, as a writer, but you have been wonderfully supportive as a reviewer of my work. And talking about constructive criticism, I've always learned something reading your reviews of my work. And can I say thank you very, very much for your kind words, because whatever authors say, we read every single review of our work, and reviews like yours mean the world to be heard and to be understood. So thank you very much for all your support. It has meant masses, than I can say.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy my reviews. You know, sometimes I read books that I just really cannot review because I think, no, you know, it's not fair to say, oh, this is a one star because it's just my opinion. And so I don't place those kind of reviews. I feel like, you know, reviews are opinions. And if I think something's bad, it's my opinion. And if I think it's so bad that I wouldn't rate it a high rating, I'm not going to tell others about the book because, you know, let them form their opinion. I'm not going to say, hey, but I do like reviewing books that, hey, I want everyone to read this book. I think this is a great book. And so then, you know, it's like, okay, look at my review. If you like it, you know, you see what I have to say. If you follow my reviews, hopefully you think, yeah, I'm a good judge of books. But if I don't like a book, you know, someone had asked me that before, you know, how come I never see any 1 or 2 star reviews? It's because I'm not going to give those. I'm not going to do those reviews. Those are books that, no, I'm not going to bother with reviewing.
I totally understand that.
I don't, you know, and maybe some people think it's wrong of me to do it that way, but I just feel that, you know, it is opinions, and I don't want to deter anyone from reading someone's work and then saying, oh, you know, looking at my review and saying, oh, well, I'm not even going to bother them because, no, you know, you may like it. I've read books that others have given 5-star reviews to, and I thought, oh, wait, I don't see what they're seeing. What am I missing?
Yeah.
I'm the same.
Yeah.
But it means also now that you're writing mainly out of love about the things that you love, as opposed to, you know, some people can only enjoy things if they're tearing them down. But obviously you want to celebrate stuff, which, again, A, makes me feel even more flattered about the nice things you said about my work, but also it makes me feel much more trusting of your opinion in the stuff that you've read. And I thought, oh, I must read that then.
I don't give them lightly, you know, the 5-star reviews. I mean, or the 4-star reviews. I mean, some books, yeah, I mean, I'll give 4. I've even, you know, 3-star books. They're good books. Maybe there's some things that maybe I thought, but, you know, it's still a good read, and it's still an enjoyable read. So, you know, I'll talk about those. But, yeah, when you get down to where there's nothing there I really cared for, but someone else may, I'm not going to deter someone else from reading the author's work. I don't think it's fair to do it that way. So
no, I agree.
How I review. But, yes, I've enjoyed all your work. And
thank
Madam
you so
Perry,
much.
I enjoy your show.
Oh, pardon me?
It's a 5-star show.
I enjoy your shows. I don't always participate and call in, but I do listen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Paul. That means a great deal to me. It really does. Thank you. I'm so flattered. Well, I'm so happy to have you here. And I just want to say, too, before we go, folks, because this has been such a wonderful party, I might need to get a bigger bottle. wait a minute. Wait. Paula doesn't know. Paula, people have said that, I don't know if you noticed this yet or not because it's kind of dim, but people say that Madame Perry's salon, it looks like the inside of Jeannie's bottle in here. That's why there's so many cushions on the floor. Not that there's a beaded curtain. Okay. I don't want you to think I'm a lush.
Okay.
That's just Alan stuff. But if you are, I don't mean to offend you. A lot of my best friends are luscious, so don't worry about that. Isn't that right, Sharon?
Luscious.
She's my sugar baby. Oh, I got to tell you a story. Kenya, Alan recently was out to dinner somewhere, and he had on his nice seersucker suit, and somebody came in and thought that he was their representative and said, aren't you? And then said, why, yes,
well,
I am.
They came in. Let me tell the story. They came in and sat down, and we were at a bar listening to some music. I was wearing a seersucker suit, and it was in July. And this lady came over and said, I know you. You're somebody. And I said, no, I'm not anybody. No, you can't fool me. I know. And went on, and finally she said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm the congressman from the 13th District of North Carolina. And she said, I knew it. I voted for you. And she discussed my platform, which was completely hysterical because there is no 13th District in Congress of North Carolina. She remembered getting things in the mail. And she bought me some wings and a couple martinis, so it was good. I told her it could no way influence my future voting record, though.
Or stop you from taking a little grass, did it?
Yeah,
that's a good bit of grift. I'll have to remember that. I don't know how it will work quite in the UK.
Tell them you're an MP, you know.
That's funny.
Okay. I want to say, I'm so glad you told that. You tell it better than I do. So I just want to say this has been such a wonderful party here at Madame Perry Salon. I am grateful to everybody who is listening, whether they called or not. Thank you so much. Thanks to my guest, Jasper Bark. I know you're going to get all of his new books. And, of course, we got to give a shout-out, Jasper, to this guy who claims to be your number one fan, Keith Harper, Kenya's boyfriend.
Oh, he really is your number one fan. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. He can name everything you've ever done. The first time I met him, I mentioned, he's a big fan.
Big shout-out to Keith.
He probably has all the new books already. Also want to thank Randy Blazak for calling in, and Glenn Tickle, comedian, Tim. Kenya Colbert, her show's on Friday nights, Everything Relationships. Mercedes Yardley, thank you so much, dear, for sending a message in to Jasper, as well as Becky Kyle. Becky Cerberus, you're just going to have to figure out how many eyes. What are you, an optician or something? or trying to keep his insurance down. What? Andrea Robinson, honey, I adore you. I'm so glad you're here. Paula Limbaugh, this is an honor. And I want to say shout outs to my sponsors tonight, Pet Detox, Pet Detox. Just send them pet. If you want to, if you go on the website, pet 20, PET20 will get is the promo code for a special on that. Also Corkscrew Films, Corkscrew the movie, and all this stuff is on Madame Perry's page on Facebook. And Kimberly Klexka, she writes children's books and she has writes them in several languages. She even has music for each one, and not only music for each one, because she was a guest on Kenya's children's program. She has the music in different styles. Like you can get it jazz, rap, hip hop. I'm going to be doing the music. I'm going to be singing on one of the records for one of her children's books that's coming out soon. That's called Dobby. Dobby's so polite. He's such a delight. And that is about a dog, a big dog named Dobby. And yes, Kenya, I'm going to be singing on it. And yeah, I'm excited. And then what else? Oh, and her book, Alok's Cool Place in Outer Space. If you've got kids, that book right now, go to Amazon. It is free from the 21st to the 25th. Kimberly Klexka, friend, sponsor, absolute doll. And happy birthday to Kimberly. Have we got everybody taken care of? Jasper Bark's newest book, The Final Cut, Run to Ground, Bed of Crimson Joy. Let me tell you, I've read almost all of his books. There is not a clunker in the bunch, is there, Paula?
No, there isn't.
Great.
Thank you very much.
I recommend them all.
Nothing drags, nothing clunker. And it's just, they'll just hold you tight. And Jasper, I was so excited about you coming online, coming tonight. I even went and had my hair done today and got a new color. Just want you to know how special you are.
Don't you look stunning?
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
I hope so. All right, so Jasper, will you come back sometime and tell us more? There's never enough time for you.
I would love to. Absolutely love to.
All right, thank you so much. And I think at this point, I'm just going to have to say, would you like to hear, would you like to go out with a song from my CD?
We'd love
to.
Yeah, okay.
And thank you for having me.
Oh, and don't forget, I'm delighted that you've been had. And, the congressman from the 13th District of North Carolina showed up, for Pete's sake. So get out there, JasperBark.com.
I'm doubly honored.
Yes, and Madam, so if you're driving through North Carolina and get in trouble, you know who to call.
The man in the suit, look at suit.
I know. All right, I love you, Jasper Bark. I love you.
Good night,
all.
Thank you. Mother Goose.